You're listening to Love and Revolution Radio, covering the heart of change and changes of the heart, featuring stories of ordinary, extraordinary people who are waging struggles for love and revolution. Love and
Revolution. This week on Love and Revolution Radio, Kit Miller from the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence in Rochester, New York, discusses how to ground huge philosophies of nonviolence, permaculture, and systems change into tangible, hands-on action in our local neighborhoods for powerful, transformative change.
Well, one of the notions that was important to Gandhi was the idea of Swadeshi, which was thinking locally, both economically, but as well as just philosophically, charitably. So studying Gandhi, to me, it made sense for us, at least in the first 5 or 6 years of my being here, that we would really focus on what could be done right where we are, rather than going like a mile wide and an inch deep.
When God stood before you with her hands on her hips,
hello, this is Sherry Mitchell for Love and Revolution Radio. Kwe, Aguanu. Hello and welcome to you in my native language. I'm coming to you from my home in the Don Land along the beautiful Penobscot River here in Bunawabskek Territory in central Maine. And I'm joined today, as always, by my luminescent co-host, Miss Rivera Sun, and our special guest, Kit Miller. Hello, Rivera.
Hi, Sherry. You know, I was thinking today that Daniel Berrigan passed on this past weekend before we recorded this show, and what a giant of nonviolence he was, and just an incredible priest, activist, anti-war activist, a kind of a giant whose shoulders we all stand on in this field. So I just wanted to lift my hat to him and his spirit as he passes on, and the spirit from him that walks on this earth in many of us. But, you know, one of the things that Daniel Berrigan's story reminds me about in how our spirit and our energy continues to walk on the earth long after we are gone is actually kind of thematic to today's show. We're going to have Kit Miller on the show, and she is the director of the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence, which is located in Rochester, New York, in a formerly abandoned building. And the work of the Gandhi Institute, as the name implies, really derives quite a bit from M.K. Gandhi. Now, Kit, who's going to join us today, works on applications of nonviolence on projects related to racism, restorative justice, and sustainability. And that's one of the exciting things we get to talk to her about is how she and the Institute have translated Gandhi's lessons in life and teachings to this very particular location in upstate New York. Welcome to the show, Kit.
Thank you, Rivera. Thank you, Sherry.
Kit, it's wonderful to have you here with us today. Now, you have been learning and organizing for nonviolence for more than 20 years in a variety of capacities. And we are very interested on this show about learning how people come to nonviolence. So I would love to hear your story of how you came to the field of nonviolence and how your journey has unfolded from the beginning until now.
Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity to speak about it. Well, my story is a very homely one. I really became interested in nonviolence when I started having children. And especially when I decided I wanted, along with my husband, I wanted to stay home with them. I was a single mom when my daughter Molly was born. And a couple of years later, we have our second daughter, Audrey. And then we have our beautiful son, Alec, who came to us from my husband's first marriage. And when I became a parent, was quite a shock for me. I was raised in a house with some violence growing up. And when I became a parent, all of that conditioning came roaring in. And it scared me, honestly. I'd also been fortunate enough to been volunteering at a local hospice and noticed at this little small urban two-bed facility that regardless of what, you know, socioeconomic, racial, professional background that people had that I was caring for, many of them spent their last months or weeks or days really either celebrating or mourning the relationships that they did or didn't take care of. And a lot of it was mourning, honestly. And so it just, for whatever reason, felt really clear to me that I needed to do a better job with my kids. I didn't want the conditioning that I'd been handed. I didn't want to hand it on. So I decided to try to understand how to do things differently, how to basically retool my personality. And around that time, someone showed me this terrible, terrible quality video of this guy, Marshall Rosenberg, who at that point was, you know, just starting to share his ideas about nonviolent communication around the United States and just starting at that point to share it in other parts of the world. And this is pre-internet, pre-most all the books on that topic. So I became interested in it, but there wasn't a lot to study. So I just began my own journey of exploration, first initially with nonviolent communication, which I became very involved in, and then as years went by, increasingly interested in restorative justice and restorative practices. I studied permaculture, which I think of as a nonviolent design system. And then when I was offered the position here at the Institute, really, you know, did an even deeper dive than I had previously done on Gandhian nonviolence and Kingian nonviolence. And I've now had the privilege of traveling with members of the Gandhi family in India and in South Africa, really learning deeply about Gandhi's footsteps. So it's been a rich, rich, rich journey.
Tell us a little bit about the origins of the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence and how that came about and what your role has been since you joined them.
The Institute is 25 years old, and it was founded by Sunanda and Arun Gandhi when they moved from Mumbai, India, to Christian Brothers University. They started the Institute at Christian Brothers University in Memphis, Tennessee. And the Institute was particularly founded in part to have them bring what they knew about nonviolence to bear on issues of racism in the Southeast United States. Arun is a grandson of M.K. Gandhi. He grew up at Phoenix Ashram in South Africa. So he was surrounded from his earliest days by that philosophy in this first ashram that Gandhi founded in the very early days of the 20th century after reading John Ruskin's book, Unto This Last. And he grew up surrounded by the philosophy. And then when he was 12 or 13 years old, he actually went and lived with his grandparents in India for a couple of years, really at the height of Gandhi's political power in the late 40s. So he had this extraordinary childhood and early adulthood and has spent his life really trying to keep that flame going and has done some beautiful work himself. So it's a privilege to have him be an elder in my life. So that the Institute was down at Christian Brothers University and doing good work. And then Sunanda, unfortunately, contracted cancer. And the only close family that the two of them had in the United States at that time was up here in Rochester, New York. Their daughter lived here. So they relocated the Institute. It was based at the University of Rochester. Sunanda passed away. I joined the Institute a couple of years later, after Arun had stepped back from it, from active leadership. And when I got to the Institute, I was very, you know, grateful to the University of Rochester for their support and their support that they continue to give us. And at the time, because I had been doing more community-based work in Oakland, being on a really beautiful, prestigious college campus didn't feel like quite a fit for the mission of the Institute. So I was able to have some good conversations with people over some months, and they were willing to have us move the Institute off campus to our current location, which is, as you mentioned earlier, Rivera, a formerly abandoned building. And it was a beautiful journey that from the first time that we came here with headlamps and crowbars and boots and literally pried the boards off the windows and the doors on the downstairs. We moved in when the house was still being rehabbed. It looked like an abandoned house for the first year and a half we were here. And for a long time, there was a lot of beauty on the inside and nothing good on the outside, which is a good metaphor for the work. So often we dismiss people's appearance, not knowing how much beauty there is inside. So we love being here, and it's a neighborhood with its fair share of violence and challenges, and also strength and resilience, and it's good to be here. And it's walking distance from university students who are willing to come and learn with us here.
Now, looking at the mission of the Institute, one of the goals of the Institute is to help individuals and communities to create public awareness of nonviolence, not just in regard to addressing conflict, but as knowledge that's critical to human thriving. One of the things that I found really interested in reading some of your materials is this workshop that you do on anger. As you know, our emotions are critical to us being able to determine where we are in the world and how we're fitting into the world and what the state of our being is in any given moment. One of the things that I talk a lot about is about understanding how we all carry this intense grief as a result of the historical trauma that we've all been a participant in to some degree. So I really enjoyed reading this brief piece that I found of yours on anger and its purpose and its value in determining whether or not we're okay. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I'm increasingly fascinated by energy sources of all kinds. And I really see anger as one of the energy sources that sometimes people use to propel themselves out of or into big changes. And I'm also interested in how there's different kinds of anger, although sometimes we just sort of, at least in white culture that I grew up in this country, you know, anger was bad and the people that were angry were bad and they needed to be marginalized and distanced. And you weren't even going to be listened to unless you could speak in a calm, modulated tone with a lot of logic. So, you know, one of the things that it feels important to me is to support people to become really curious. I think of curiosity as a meta skill for nonviolence. To become curious and really have a good understanding of their own anger so that they can be around the anger of other people in a relaxed way. And I think that there's a kind of anger that we have towards ourselves and towards each other, which is useful to translate and release. I think carrying bitterness and resentment towards other people is just this like drinking salt water when you're thirsty. But there's also this really beautiful, important moral outrage and anger that, you know, we can feel towards injustice in the world. And so many of the systems that now exist in the world that were set up to serve people, but now seemingly people serve systems. So I want us to be able to get, like, more sophisticated in how we relate to anger and have more mercy in relationship to it. But I think it's an important emotion that's beautiful and misunderstood.
Now, one of the things that you do at the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence is a lot of work with the local youth. You employ some of them to do restorative justice and development work within the community, and you also engage the younger than high school graduate level youth in change and transformation. Would you speak a little bit about that and maybe some of the roles of anger within that work?
One of the things that I'm interested in is working with, like, human energies, I said earlier, and anger being one of them. But one of the other really wonderful human energies is our resistance to authority and the resistance to just going along with the status quo. And so one of the approaches that we sometimes take with young people is to, instead of talking about violence as a bad thing, is to just start getting curious about violence itself. Well, like, what do you understand about violence? And, you know, what is it that's so common? Obviously, there must be some reasons for its existence. And so we spend time looking at violence and powerful looking at internal violence versus interpersonal violence, introducing the idea of structural violence, I remember the first time I said the word structural violence to a group of teenagers in the north side of the city here, and one of them said, "You mean like what, like a building reaches out and hits you upside the head? Structural violence? That's what you mean?" So the way that we often frame violence is that interpersonal violence especially is really a downstream consequence of internal violence and structural violence. But so many of the forms of social control that are focused on managing and containing interpersonal violence without attending to the inside job or the internal violence or the structural roots. So what happens when you basically only pay attention to secondary effects and don't look at root cause? You essentially make sure that the status quo can continue. So it's really a joyful privilege that in a lot of the settings where we work in schools, we get to share these ideas with kids. And I remember a few years ago speaking about structural violence and speaking about suffering as one of the ways in which we might choose to change, make changes in suffering, and talking about in the way that Gandhi and King both did, our willingness to suffer to make change. And one of this young dynamic person named Denzel, who was 17 years old at the time, leaped up to his feet and started to preach basically to his colleagues and peers and saying, "Well, we know about suffering, don't we? We all know about suffering." You know, all the kids in that room had lost 5 or 6 young friends, you know, people in their lives to violence. I mean, many urban neighborhoods across this country, it's like a war zone. So to be able to, like, give people a more nuanced perspective and an open and relaxed, let's talk about violence, you know, not just say violence is bad, but really look at it. And anger and violence are completely related to each other. So I think it's really refreshing. It opens up like a new space of inquiry and possibilities when we begin to say, well, of course violence has its uses or else it wouldn't be so common. Why are people violent? Let's look at that. What are the downsides of violence? Let's raid the funds of knowledge of the people in the room, whether you're 12 or 13 or 72. Let's talk about like why do these things exist? And let's use what you know about your life rather than stand up in the front of the room and act like an expert. So we have pretty good success in connecting with people through what they know and respecting their experience around these topics and engaging. And we've been lucky because we get to say some pretty radical things within these school buildings, and somehow they let us keep coming, and they even pay us for it.
Well, that's nice.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, that's quite the achievement to have them pay you to come in and to help them to create these transformations. So this is part of your school climate transformation project, right? And
yes.
There are a number of things that are connected to that. One of them is creating climates of peace. And so I'm interested, we all have our own stories about the impacts of violence in our lives, whether it's direct, structural, lateral violence. And I'm interested to see how you found the distinction between maybe some of the staff in the school having very different experiences from what the students have experienced, and how you can bridge that knowledge gap in order to get people operating from the same place to be able to address some of these issues in relation to social emotional development, conflict transformation within the school, within the environment, within that entire community. Do you have experiences that you can relate to us around some of those challenges that maybe you faced in regard to these really diverse experiences with violence and how you create understanding and a broader spectrum for all participants?
Yeah, it's interesting. One of the things that I speak to my colleagues about, who are especially the people that are school-based every day, is I really ask them and keep checking in with them in relation to how able they are to see everybody, every human in the building as part of our work, part of our ministry. It's relatively easy to go into buildings and see the students as being stressed, distressed, even oppressed, depending on your perspective. And it's harder to see the adults in the building with that same compassion. And one of the things that I work hard on with colleagues here is for us to continue to develop a more sophisticated capacity to think systemically. And if you're a systems thinker, you see that everybody in an oppressive system is oppressed. So everybody within that space, even if they on the outside look like they've got it all, you know, in relation. So then maybe, you know, we're talking about like a white middle class teacher who was able to get their bachelor's degree and their master's degree, and they don't seem to have much of an idea of the reality maybe of their students. Some of them dealing with multi-generational poverty and all that kind of stuff that's pretty common here in the city. So one perspective that's important is that we recognize that nobody in a system like that isn't suffering, that everybody is suffering. And to try to be in a respectful, supportive space of everybody and not dismiss or disregard the concerns or the challenges for people in the system, even the ones who appear to have more structural power. Because I think one of the aspects of power that's interesting is that nobody really sees, even people who have structural power genuinely sometimes don't see themselves that way. So when you just are there to educate them that they do, they don't respond to it very well. So the whole idea of empathy before education is one that I loved hearing years ago from Marshall Rosenberg, and it's one of the important ideas. So first, I want to connect with a teacher, or connect with an administrator, and I do this in one of the buildings. I go in and spend time with the building leadership, thinking about how we can continue the work on school climate, as well as working with administrators in the central office. And so usually when I go there, I just start by just affirming people, the effort that they're making, the care that they have, the choice that they're making to be there. I mean, they don't have to be there. Many of them could go off somewhere, but they're choosing to be there. So first we start with that before we would necessarily like start sticking our fingers in people's chest. I really believe that people don't change because of being made to feel ashamed or guilty. We change when we're understood, and then we're encouraged to do better. And that includes white people who want to overlook the fact of racism in their lives. It includes people with rank and power differences who don't want to acknowledge that they see themselves as powerless and are frustrated when other people see them as powerful. I think that having a perspective of first seeking to understand and then ask to be understood is critical to how we've been able to be as successful as we are.
Kid, one of the things that we spoke about on a previous phone call together was the emphasis on localizing the effort. Now, with your founder being the grandchildren of Gandhi, you could have taken a total global approach to this work. I mean, the impact of Gandhi is felt literally around the world. But instead, you made a choice, and a very intentional choice, to localize your efforts and to root your efforts in the hands-on engagement with your local community. Will you speak more about that choice and about why this is a very Gandhian philosophy?
Yes, thanks. Well, one of the notions that was important to Gandhi was the idea of Swadeshi, which was thinking locally, both economically, but as well as just philosophically, charitably. So studying Gandhi, to me, it made sense for us, at least in the first 5 or 6 years of my being here, that we would really focus on what could be done right where we are, rather than going like a mile wide and an inch deep in terms of our programming, which would be more kind of, frankly, more symbolic. I'm not so interested in the study of nonviolence for the sake of the study. I'm more interested in wheels on the ground. What does that actually mean in a neighborhood like the one that we're in? So with a lot of humility, we decided to really look around and say, well, what could we do right here? And that's been an important inquiry. So, you know, we have this house now is, I think of it as sort of a living museum for nonviolence. It has like all the qualities, even in really tiny quantities of a museum. There's a collection of photos of Gandhi around the house. There's a small library that's available for people to borrow with some really terrific books and DVDs on nonviolence, King, Gandhi, racism. And the house is used as a public space by groups, a wide variety of groups, from a 4-H group of girls to one of our local partners, Teen Empowerment, does their youth police dialogues, Veterans for Peace. The local chapter meets here, the Alternative Violence Program. We host a youth employment project called Seed Folks, and they're a wonderful community partner. So we want people to be in and out. There's like a weaving of the human fabric that feels like it's happening here by having lots of different kinds of people weaving in the races, the ages, the religions. So that's part of, for me, what we're here for, to try to build as many connections as possible across disparate elements. Years ago, I had the opportunity to learn with systems thinker Margaret Wheatley. And it was interesting because she'd been writing these fascinating books about systems and human systems in relation to the natural world and the comparisons between them. So by the time I actually had a chance to meet with her, she had just fallen in love with Buddhism. And I was just like, thanks, but I'm not here to talk about Buddhism. I want to talk systems. So she gave me like a 5 minutes. Okay, what do you want to ask me about? So I said to her, how do you take down a system? I think a lot of our systems are broken. How do you take it down? And she said, you can't take down systems. They're very robust and resilient, and that's why they emerged in the first place. So you can't take down. I said, well, okay, well, what does take down a system? She said, what takes down a system is the emergence of a new system that comes in and basically outcompetes for energy with the old system, and life votes with its feet and moves to the new system. Okay, so then I said, so how does a new system get created? And she said, well, new systems are created when discrete networks form so many different linkages, kind of like a neural net that becomes stronger and stronger until at some point, boom, it tips, and now you have a new system. So my job and my perspective has always been to be a facilitator between discrete networks, to build the connections. And so we use the Gandhi Institute as a place to help facilitate that, from doing trainings. Yesterday I facilitated an afternoon for an urban co-housing group that's been struggling. 2 days before that, I worked with Hispanic Latino organization that mostly does work in schools. The day in between that, two of my colleagues work with some kids from a very prestigious private school that came here. We want the whole world to be coming here, soaking up information about nonviolence, and then going back out again like bees with pollen on their wings. So that's part of what we're here for, and we're doing it from within a neighborhood that most of the white people in the Rochester area don't know. So they have to come here for that, and that's part of the pollen being on their wings when they leave. Now they know this neighborhood. I actually have two different sets of directions for people when they're coming here. If it's a person of color, I tell them we're just down the street from a funeral home that everybody knows if you're black in this community, because it's the oldest African-American-owned business in the city. If it's a white person, I have a completely different set of directions because none of them ever heard of that funeral home. So I want it to be a hub and a space for people to learn and see that the world from a different perspective.
I'm so interested in what you said regarding the creation of new systems, because that's exactly what I teach in my nonviolence workshops, is that, you know, we have to have this understanding that what we feed grows, and mm-hmm. what we put our energy into is what we're going to cultivate, nurture, and expand. And if all we're doing is trying to dismantle old systems, then we invest all of our energy into those old systems. And what happens when you have a break, when it grows back, it's stronger. You're actually strengthening those systems in your attempts to dismantle them. They're becoming stronger and more resilient. They're learning how to protect themselves from all of these different angles. And the most powerful thing that we can do is for us to be able to create new systems that actually meet the needs of the people, that address some of these underlying causes of violence, one of which is this startling inequity that exists within the country and around the world in various places, not just here.
And we'll be back after a quick break for Station ID and your weekly dose of nonviolence.
Remember your brother at the end of the line. Remember your sister at the end of the line. Remember the least of these. They are divine. We're all walking each other home.
On this week's Nonviolence Minute, Mohandas K. Gandhi takes the spotlight, as he should, on a show about an institute named in his honor and founded by his grandson, Arun. For most people, the name Gandhi conjures up the image of a man in a white cotton garment who used nonviolence to gain India's independence from Great Britain after 200 years of corporate and colonial rule. Yes, that's right, corporate rule. Prior to being ruled by the British Crown, the East India Company ruled India for 100 years, more or less, as a corporate colony. The phrase should make all of us in the modern world sit up and pay attention. And for those who are most curious, a quick online search will reveal the fascinating connections in the entwined history of companies, nations, monarchies, tyranny, and colonies, and the modern-day ramifications. Getting back to Gandhi, it should be noted that the Indian independence movement shared many attributes with the pre-war American independence movement in the late 1700s. They both used widespread boycotts of British goods, constructive programs for building local self-reliance, non-cooperation with British law, establishing parallel governments and legal courts, civil disobedience, and much more. If we take a closer look at Gandhi's powerful program of Swadeshi, a word our guest Kit Miller referenced in today's show, which means self-sufficiency, we can see many parallels between the two movements and our contemporary world. Wikipedia says that the Swadeshi movement, part of the Indian independence movement, was an economic strategy aimed at removing the British Empire from power and improving economic conditions in India by following the principles of Swadeshi, self-sufficiency. Now, Justice Kit Miller mentioned that she isn't interested in nonviolence as a philosophy simply for philosophy's sake, but rather for how we can use nonviolence in our everyday lives. Let's think for a moment about the applications of Swadeshi, or self-sufficiency, in our contemporary times. We, like Gandhi and many others, also suffer from the decisions and policies of an economic political machine run by transnational mega-corporations. Which, by the way, is what the East India Company was in its heyday. We also struggle with the control of our political governments by these business interests. By practicing local self-reliance and self-sufficiency, we can withdraw our cooperation from destructive businesses and policies, and instead put our energy, time, and money into life-affirming projects that support and uplift our friends and neighbors. In so doing, we not only strengthen our community's resiliency, we also resist the problems posed by destructive corporations. If you look at history again and again, you see the threads of lessons and knowledge that can be used in today's world. That's why we say, know your nonviolent history, because it might change your life.
We are walking.
The featured music this week is Walking Each Other Home by Jenny Bird from her Sage Songs CD. You can find her wonderful music at www.jennybird.com. And now, let's return to our program.
One of the creative things that I think that you're doing that people would not ordinarily associate with nonviolence is your work in regard to sustainability and permaculture. One of the things that people don't always connect to violence is this lack of ability to be able to sustain yourself, that it's really an act of frustration and almost franticness in being able to survive, to be able to get your basic needs met. You know, we have this view that everyone should be able to climb the ladder, but if you're too small of a child, if you're sick, or if you're too weak to pull yourself up, you can't even get onto the ladder. You can't pull yourself up by your bootstraps if you have no boots. you can't go into an educational system and be able to learn if your brain isn't properly nourished with the proper food that you need to be able to sustain your bodily systems. So I would love for you to talk about the sustainability programs that you're initiating and how you see those coming into the work of nonviolence that you're doing.
Well, a big part of it has been support for urban agriculture initiatives over the years that I've been here. Was involved in a major working group effort a couple of years ago in for the city of Rochester, a plan that was shelved but now is pulled out, and they're starting to stand on the shoulders of it, which is great because a bunch of us put in hundreds of hours into that effort. Doing educating people in relationship to consumption and social justice, educating people to rethink food as a basic right. Some years ago, we had this extraordinary scholar from Toronto, someone who's been studying this amazing work that they were doing down in Brazil in the city of Belo Horizonte around food as a basic right and the whole idea of people having access to food, access to healthy food as something that was just this basic human right. And because, especially because we are living in a USDA food desert in the community where we're situated right now, the growing of food that we're doing here, the fact that the garden here, we have just under an acre here, which manages to feed an amazing number of people. The half acre is managed by this youth organization called Seed Folks that we support with training and hosting. And then some of the food from that garden is also just shared with neighbors. And it's this beautiful kind of open arrangement. I think one of the things that especially urban gardens grow can grow isn't just food, it's trust. I remember last year there was a man going over the collard beds, and he was picking them really quickly like a professional picker. And I was on the phone with somebody. I looked out and I said to one of my colleagues, could you go and tell him about the idea behind the garden? So she went out and she said, do you know that this garden is maintained by youth and they sell their produce at the farmer's market in the neighborhood. So we ask people from neighbors who come just to take what they need, but not to take more than that, so the youth will have produce to sell on Tuesday at the market. And he said, oh, okay. So he stopped picking. And then a week later, he brought his father back because he wanted his father to see it. And I was at a picnic table having a meeting because when the weather's nice in Rochester, you have to get outside, for God's sake. And so he said, I'm just going to come and take what I need, and I wanted my father to see this place. And I said, great, I love it. So we don't legislate that. We trust people in a neighborhood where trust is in the shortest supply as fresh organic produce is. So I think that that's one of the things that feels important for me. We're about to build a chicken house here, and we're going to be doing a little worm business here, starting here this summer. This summer we're doing our fourth year in a row of working, doing a little program for 5 and 6 year old people called Peace in the Garden. And they'll be learning about relationships between plants, relationships between people, and it will be led by my incredibly charismatic 20-year-old colleague, Hootie Miller, who grew up two doors down from here, who's passionate about little people and peace and gardening. So it's going to be led by very young people who are going to be working with littler people, all neighborhood-based. And so we're just going to keep on experimenting with what this commitment means for us. We also are sustainable in terms of the house, and so we compost, and we have a stream of food at our events for chickens, and so there's chicken food, there's compost. So we have four waste streams. We also maintain the house ourselves. There's no invisible cleaning crew that takes care of this place. It's maintained 100% by all of us who work here as well as volunteers, which is an enormous labor of love. But so it's just really trying to walk our talk as far as sustainability goes. You know, even moving our money, when I first got here, we had the money of the Institute was in one of the big banks, and I said, sustainability means attending to the local. And so we moved our bank into one of the local banks. So looking at everything through the lens of sustainability. I want to also say that for me, the principles of permaculture are really useful management tools. I think of a lot of those ideas very often in relation to thinking about people and problems. A stacking function is a permaculture principle which talks about the fact that everything in nature serves many, many, many purposes. Like a tree that's native to its biome will have over 100 beneficial relationships both above and below the soil, whereas a tree or another plant that's a non-native species, that's even one that's been there for 100 years, might have 10 or 12 or 15. So the resilience is much, much higher for native species. And so thinking about native species here, but also thinking about when we do something here, well, what's our stacking function for choosing to do it? If it doesn't have several stacking functions, is it the right way for us to use our resources or not? So trying to have sustainability really be into the marrow of what we do, and also linking it to consumption, because what we say in a lot of our trainings is that even if we had no problems with any other nation on the earth, our consumption would lead to problems. For decades now, I think we've been less than 5% of the world's population consuming 40% of its resources and generating significantly like 25% of the waste. I haven't looked at those numbers lately, so they're probably outdated. But the way our standard of living is taking food out of the mouths of children in other places, and it's taking food out of the mouths of children, of our own children, who aren't even born yet. We've got to take responsibility for that, and we've got to find a way to make it feel like a party and not a funeral, as Rob Hopkins from the Transition Movement talks about.
You know, these concepts of sustainability are so very exciting in terms of how you're applying them to human-based systems as well. I love the native species analogy of how many beneficial relationships it has. It reminds me of your work with the youth and how you have participant-led dialogues, all of which tap into the local and the already pre-existent web of resilience and communication that exists within your community. It's so invigorating to hear you speak about that. What do you say when people call you up and say, we love what you're doing, we want to do that in our community? How do people get started on that journey?
Come here and visit. Come and stay as long as you want. I'll find you a free room in the neighborhood, and you can just come and spend some time. Our staff meetings are open. People can just come and sit down and be a part of it. And we have this beautiful set of staff expectations, which we're almost done and pretty soon able to put on our website, but we're still just fine-tuning it. But I love how we operate with each other. There's a tremendous amount of integrity and transparency to that, and it really relates to Gandhi and ideas of means and ends. You know, we have to have our means be as perfect as we can make them, as we can humanly make them, and then we have to relax and let the ends take care of themselves. So for sure, coming and visiting is a strategy. We have this cool project, these Gandhi cards that we've made a few years ago. Those are on our website, and that's a way for us to export some of the learning that we've had around how to share ideas and principles of nonviolence with people of all ages. I use them with groups, all kinds of groups. I'll jumpstart a conversation on any topic in the world off these Gandhi cards. So those are available for sale. We also have 3-day and five-day intensives, and we have had people from all over the world swing in and visit those. The next one is August 8th through 10th, and it will be led in part by 14 and 15-year-olds who are hiring to become peacemakers over the summertime who are going to be learning with us, and their graduation ceremony will be to help to lead that 3-day intensive, so that'll be fun learning for everybody. We also have been partnering with a school in Los Angeles doing webinars for teachers and students, and we're just sticking our toe in the water now with sharing what we're doing through webinars, so which feels like a very sustainable way of sharing ideas rather than anybody needing to burn petroleum, other than the petroleum that's already burned by the manufacturer of the computer that you're sitting in front of. And the last thing is that we're working on taking the information from the Gandhi cards and making it into some kind of a free internet app. We're working on that now, and that's going to be a summer project. So we're just really, I feel like there's a kind of a maturity happening in relation to some of what we're doing that we can begin to start sharing it. But people are entirely welcome to come and hang out. And you know, we've had visitors from around the world who've stayed for days, weeks, months, or years, and we welcome you.
And Kit, I also want you to tell our listeners a little bit about the Gandhi Service Fellowship Program. I know that you have had some success with that program in regard to past fellows going on and continuing to be engaged in action in their local community. So can you talk a little bit about the opportunities that are available with the fellowship program and then what some of the fellows have done once they've left the program and gone forward with their lives?
Sure. Yeah. The Gandhi Fellows Program was a program that was started, I think it's in its fifth year, and it's basically a chance for us to work with somewhere between four to eight undergrads. This year we have eight undergrads and graduates from Rochester area colleges. We work intensely with them doing training and community building and start to mentor them into doing a project of their choosing, which we also will help to fund. We've had students who've chosen to stay with us as fellows over a course of several years, some just are with us for 1 year. Fellows can really choose the project that their heart desires. Probably one of the ones that has been a very rich one, I know, was one that was started some years ago by a fellow named Joseph Gardella, who leveraged that and a lot of other hard work into a fifth-year scholarship at the University of Rochester, where he continued to study urban education and nonviolence, and he ended up going off to Vanderbilt and doing a wonderful and still finishing a master's PhD program there, and I believe he serves now maybe on the board of advisors for the Meta Center. He's just a terrific young person. Another young woman who's just heading off to medical school has been with us for many years, and her passion as a young Muslim woman has been interfaith dialogue. So she started a tradition that now has outlasted her of creating these interfaith banquets, which are so critical in the world now. And she's been to Oman and along with her brother, who's also a fellow with us, and they did projects in Oman as part of their Gandhi Service Fellowship. Now they're both heading into medical school and are outstanding representatives of their faith in the world. Gosh, there's been such a wide variety of projects. One of our fellows this year was really passionate about increasing the curriculum and understanding for LGBT youth and queer questioning youth. So she was going out and doing presentations in area high schools. Really, it's pretty diverse, and we love to use this place as a launching pad for people's inquiries. We've had some wonderful people who've done their PhD research through this place as part of that. Someone a couple of years ago, we helped to fund project that they did with young urban males, really looking at, like, well, what are the moral qualities and, like, what kind of support do people need in order to be able to rise above, like, really demanding, grueling, traumatic life circumstances. And so he defended his PhD now in his teaching, and he's an extraordinary person. And so we just had some fantastic human beings come through here. And I really think of this place as a very creative space for a project support project kind of thing. We had a woman a few years ago who didn't get a grant for a project she wanted to do. She wanted to do Pianos for Peace project. She said, I didn't get the grant, but I want to do it anyways. And I said, let's do it. She got 10 pianos donated. She put them around in some challenged neighborhoods in the city here, painted them beautifully, had neighbors take care of them, had concerts, free piano lessons, like this wonderful community building project. It was the bright spot of the city that summer that she did it, and she just actually got a full ride for social justice scholarship at the University of Austin Law School. So these are just this great cadre of young people. I want to just say really quickly, I think of everyone who works here as being in leadership school with me. From the minute they get here, I'm thinking about what's their resume going to look like when they leave this place. And I want them to show a progression of skills acquisition. Every year I sit down with people who work here and we sort of renegotiate. Now what do you want to do? Now what does next year mean? What's your growing edge? what do you want to keep doing? What do you want to let go of? And so I really think everybody who is working here is in leadership school, which is fun, including me.
Wow, you are working on so many angles and aspects of nonviolence in the context of the work that you're doing. You know, we've talked about personal development and person power. We've talked about constructive programs. We've talked about restorative justice and community building and peace building. I want to ask you about Satyagraha, though. And what do you work anything with more direct action or acts of partisan persuasion, demonstrations, protest rallies? Or are you really sticking with this kind of Gandhian formula of like 90% constructive work and only 10% obstructive work? What's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely am somewhat with that ratio. We've been, except primarily, very interested in tax resistance. So if you look on our website, you'll see a couple of essays about that. I started doing tax resistance a couple of years ago, and another staff member is as well. There's also a beautiful nonviolence campaign happening about an hour south of here, protecting water. And I've had a couple of arrests with that recently. I actually had the privilege and fun of getting arrested with Bill McKibben in early March down at Seneca Lake. If your listeners want to look it up, the campaign is called We Are Seneca Lake. It's this beautiful campaign protesting the construction of natural gas storage unit in these former salt caverns underneath an incredibly deep lake. We have to protect the water in this part of the world. It's one of the freshwater reservoirs on the planet. So there is some aspect of that going on here. And for me, it's not where my most energetic personal, I'm more interested in the building. And I'm more interested in like helping to keep the oxygen mask on the people that are trying to figure stuff out. We do have this house. It's been used by local organizations who are doing direct action work. And I have done trainings for the direct action folks as well, too. And I really can imagine it being called on more and more as our system, you know, as the wheels come off the systems here. But part of it for me was actually my last child just finally left the nest, and so I'm starting to feel freer to be able to do things that might land me in jail for a while.
Well, that's great to hear. And from a Gandhi perspective, from Joanna Macy's perspective, from so many of these giants of nonviolence, that really is the ratio, that we can't just topple systems. We can't just do holding actions to stop the worst of the damage. We also have to integrate always the construction of new systems and the building and the resilience of the people, the self-reliance and the creativity and the strength and the confidence. So I applaud your efforts and I get them in that way. I want to remind the listeners as we're heading into the last few minutes of the show that Kit Miller is the director of the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence in Rochester, New York. She likes to work on applications of nonviolence to projects related to racism, restorative justice, and sustainability. She is a mother and a stepmother, and she is a great nurturer of young souls, both young in body and young in heart. So, Kit, any last final words that you'd like to share with our listeners, things for them to ponder and consider as we're heading into the show?
I'm grateful that you mentioned Joanna Macy. She's actually going to be visiting here in a couple weeks, and I'm excited to show her this place because she's been a major teacher of mine. I guess what feels important to me is for people now to find what roots them in the world. And if you haven't examined your roots in a while, go back and look at them and make sure that they're strong, because the winds are blowing and the things are so dynamic now. And so there's so much going on. And I think we really, really, really need to make sure our support systems are in place and make sure that our roots are tended so that we can be useful in the years to come as the dynamic environment that we're in continues to become even more dynamic, possibly, all indications being that way. So that's one of the reasons why I'm as passionate as I am working with younger people, because sometimes they haven't figured out yet what roots them. And I don't think it's an easy world to be alive in if you don't have your roots yet. It's a privilege to be here and to be helping people find their roots. And I hope any listeners that out there want to figure out a way to get plugged in, my email and my phone number are on our website, and just give me a call. I'm busy as heck, but I'll get back to you.
Thank you so much for being with us today, Kit, and for all of the work that you're doing in the world. There are so many things that you're doing that give me hope. I also work with a lot of young people, and every day I find that they inspire me and they increase my level of hope because they really seem to understand the urgency of what we're facing, and they're willing to a far greater degree, even than some of those who are much older than they are, they're willing to take responsibility for creating the type of change that we need in order to sustain ourselves into the future. So I bow very humbly to you, and thanks for the work that you're doing in that regard, because I think that that's one of the most important things that we can be doing right now, is helping the young people to be able to forge these new pathways out of the mess that's been left for them, and that we have an obligation to help them in that regard and to support them in whatever way that we can to get them to where they need to be for their future generations. So thank you very much for that, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. I'm grateful for that, for the work that you guys are doing, and for the chance to be here in my little office here and share these ideas out in the world with via the efforts of you both. And I'm looking forward to continuing to find ways to play together.
Yes. Thanks this week to our guest, Kit Miller, and to my amazing co-host, Rivera Sun. Our theme song, Love and Revolution, with words and music by Diane Patterson, is performed by Diane Patterson and Spirit Radio. You can find more of her great music at www.dianepatterson.org, and you can tune in next week when Diane will be our guest.
And a special thanks to my co-host, Sherry Mitchell, for all of her wonderful, insightful comments. You can also follow what she writes and comments on at her Sacred Instructions Facebook page. Love and Revolution is a weekly radio program, and your local station can broadcast it. Just head on down there or send them an email or call them up and ask them to. You can reach us via the Love and Revolution page on my website, www.riverasun.com, and we are Love and Revolution Radio on Stitcher, iTunes, and Podomatic.
For Love and Revolution Radio, I'm Sherry Mitchell. Kit Miller gave us some really wonderful advice this week by telling us to search out our roots to make sure that they were firmly planted, and to make sure that we were also connected to others through this system of connection that we all have to one another that lies under the surface. In order for us all to weather the storms that are coming and those that we're facing right now, it's important that we have strong, intertwined roots. Perhaps you'll take some time to examine your roots and to determine their strength and depth by the time we talk to you next week. What if you knew?